Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
From his meditation under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha came to the understanding of four principles or truths regarding suffering. These principles, known as the Four Noble Truths, contain Buddha's basic teaching and encapsulate the entire Buddhist path. They are called noble because they liberate us from suffering. I'll give you a brief summary of the Noble Truths is there is suffering, first of all, in obvious and subtle forms. Then the cause of suffering is craving and fundamental ignorance. The end of suffering comes from realizing that our obscurations are temporary. They are like passing clouds that obscure the sun from our enlightened souls. And the last point, there is a path to follow. By living ethically, practicing meditation, and developing wisdom, we can take the same journey to enlightenment and freedom from suffering that the Buddhas do. As I deepen my practice and learn the Noble Truths more fully, I'm beginning to see this last statement not just as an idea, but as a promise. The very possibility that the same journey Buddhas take is available to me also actually gives me goosebumps. There are many kinds of suffering, physical, mental, emotional, etc. Today's talk will be about fear, a prevalent form of emotional suffering familiar to everyone. I have entitled it Dancing with Fear, and the title is my deliberate attempt to present fear as something that exists, something to engage with, rather than something to resist, deny, and even fear. I want to say that this talk is about not fearing fear. The preparation for this talk probably began quite subconsciously on my return from a 3-week intensive at the Green Dragon Temple, also known as Green Gulch in California, in January 2016. The intensive was a big step for me, and I went there with the support and encouragement of the Mountain Range Sangha, so I knew that I would be asked about my experience. Teachers and friends would want to know how it went. My impromptu comments to Kate were that it was quite challenging, actually somewhat of a boot camp, and I returned to Vancouver softened, strengthened, and less afraid. I don't know where the words less afraid came from. Regardless, they motivated me to look at my fears and the pervasive nature and power of fear in day-to-day life. Maybe I picked up the fear that was so present in the pre-election United States at the time. Some retreatants jokingly asked, if Trump gets elected, would you help us emigrate to Canada? Little did they know what was to follow. What is fear? From the biological and evolutionary perspective, fear is a powerful and primitive human emotion. It alerts us to the presence of danger and was critical in keeping our ancestors alive. According to this book, The Practical Neuroscience of Buddha's Brain, in order to pass on our genes, our animal ancestors had to choose correctly, many times a day, whether to approach something that could feed them, or to avoid and not become food for the saber-toothed tiger, for example. Today, humans approach and avoid mental states as well as physical objects in much the same way when we pursue self-worth and push away shame. Nevertheless, for all its sophistication, human approaching and avoiding draws on much the same neural or brain circuitry used by a monkey looking for bananas, or a lizard looking for a rock to safely hide under. The limbic system is the portion of the brain that deals with three key functions: emotions, memories, and arousal. Part of the limbic system is the amygdala, from the Greek word almond. The amygdala is an almond-shaped structure in the brain that is considered to be the seat of fear and other emotions. It is the body's alarm system. In contrast to other emotions that are filtered by the cortex, fear appears to bypass the sensory cortex on its way to the amygdala, triggering a more rapid and perhaps less deliberate response to a given situation. Fear typically arises the moment there is uncertainty. A possible response when something unfamiliar occurs could be to observe it with interest, with curiosity, to see what is happening in the moment. More than likely, when we ask ourselves out of fear, what is this all about? What's going to happen? It inevitably has nothing to do with right now. It has to do with the future. But the reality is that the future doesn't exist. It hasn't happened yet. The past doesn't exist either. It has already happened. The only thing we've got is what's right here, right now. Therefore, noticing fear and coming home to the moment makes all the difference in the world in how we deal with fear. It helps to explore how we can work with fear from the point of view of the path as Zen practitioners. How do we walk the path of our practice when we encounter fear along the way? Fear is not a trivial matter. In many ways, it restricts our lives. It imprisons us. Fear is also a tool of oppression. Because of fear, we do many harmful things, individually and collectively. And people who are hungry for power over others know and exploit it. We can be made to do things out of fear. Fear is a very tricky thing. Sometimes we put up a pretense of virtue, but really we're afraid of being bad. Are our good deeds true virtue, or just a response to fear? Fear also stops us from speaking up when we know we should. Fear is often what causes people to leave the path of Dharma. When things start to go deep beyond self-improvement, they encounter fear and say, "This path is not for me." While anger makes people aggressive, prone to lash out, fear makes them cower from the unfamiliar and seek refuge and comfort. This may be in part what took place in the latest U.S. election. We have seen Mr. Trump identify people's fears and anger. And we have seen him solve their fears, not solve, but salve their fears with promises of protection, toughness, and strength. It is a feedback loop to stir up people's latent fears and then to offer oneself as the only solution. How this plays itself out was vividly illustrated at a candidate's rally in North Carolina when a 12-year-old girl declared, "I'm scared. What are you going to do to protect this country?" And I won't try to do a Trump impersonation here, but "You know what, darling?" Trump replied, "You're not going to be scared anymore. They're going to be scared." Religion can and has employed fear in similar ways. Bertrand Russell, the renowned British philosopher, logician, mathematician, and Nobel laureate, comments in his 1927 lecture, "Why I Am Not a Christian," delivered to the National Secular Society. Russell expressed his point with characteristic clarity. Religion is based primarily and mainly upon fear. It is partly the terror of the unknown and partly the wish to feel that you have a kind of elder brother who will stand by you in all your troubles and disputes. Fear is the basis of the whole thing. Fear of the mysterious. Fear of defeat. Fear of death. Fear is the main source of superstition and one of the main sources of cruelty. To conquer fear is the beginning of wisdom. End of quote. We all have fear of death, and many have been trained to fear hell. Especially for me, having been reared Catholic, the fear of being rejected by a supposedly loving God and Him possibly sending me to eternal damnation still bears heavy scars. What about fearlessness? Is fearlessness an alternative to strive for? There are various kinds of fearlessness, some false, some real. There's the fearlessness that comes out of anger, out of converting your fear into anger in the face of danger. Sometimes useful, but that's not a lasting solution. There is the fearlessness of young people, the kind of people the military sends off to war. When you're 17 or 18, you can feel invulnerable, but false invulnerability is not a wise form of fearlessness. Fearlessness is empowered by fear. You can't develop fearlessness, real, compassionate, generous fearlessness without fear. Fearlessness is born of fear. Here is a Zen story from ancient China. A fierce band of warriors was terrorizing the countryside. As they approached a particular town, all the monks, except the abbot, fled the monastery. Charging into the monastery, the raiders found it abandoned, except for the abbot, sitting in front of the shrine room in perfect posture. Ready to strike with his sword, the fierce leader confronted the abbot. "Don't you know who I am? Don't you know that I'm the sort of person who could run you through with my sword without batting an eye?" The Zen master calmly responded, "And I, sir, am the sort of man who could be run through by a sword without batting an eye. And, sir, I am the sort of man who could be run through by a sword without batting an eye." Typical of many Zen stories or koans, this one offers no absolute ending or conclusion. We aren't told if the Zen master was killed, if his life was somehow spared, or if the leader put down his sword and became a monk. Did the story mean that it was all the same to the Zen master whether he lived or died? I don't think so, and nor do I think all this matters. The point, as I understand it now, is that he understood there was nothing at all for him to do. In the face of being killed, you have two possibilities. You can fight with the moment, either physically or mentally, and create more turmoil in your mind. Or you can say simply, this is simply what's happening. That's what happens when something as final as death is in sight. The mind gives up its usual hope for another reality. And when it gives up that hope, the mind relaxes. It doesn't have to look for something else to do. So even though it is the end, there may be pain, and it's without suffering. It was very important for me to learn the difference between suffering and pain. I had them all kind of one and the same. Suffering is the extra turmoil in the mind over and above the pain of body and mind. The absence of that tension is absence of suffering. The Zen master was able to let go of that tension. Again, back to my upbringing. Having been raised Catholic, and given that Catholics, along with fundamentalists Muslims, consider martyrdom to be a good thing, I had to ask, was this Zen master being a martyr? I doubt it. There was no God to adulate. There was no display of feigned or exaggerated suffering to obtain sympathy or admiration, or no ticket to heaven. He was simply responding in the now. I kept coming back to this part of the talk, enhancing it with each visit. I guess I grew up very fearful of death and continued to be fascinated by the abbot's fearless acceptance of inevitable death, or what looked like inevitable death, we don't know. And I, sir, am the sort of man who could be run through by a sword without batting an eye. These words, rather the state of heart and mind they portray, kept following me around like a haunting shadow. Then I remembered the saying, it's a good day to die. The quote attributed to the Lakota chief Crazy Horse, preparing for the battle of the Little Bighorn. No, it was not a death wish, because he did not even die. It seems that by being willing to die, Crazy Horse was able to lead the native armies to total victory over General Custer and the U.S. 7th Cavalry. Then there was the experience of the Austrian Jewish neurologist and psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who survived 3 years in concentration camps. He noted that fellow inmates who accepted what was happening, did they like it? I'm sure not. But accepted what was happening had the best chance of surviving it. But I digress, and it's so easy. From the Buddhist perspective, fear is a form of suffering, like an arrow in Mara's quiver. Mara, I'll tell you who Mara is. Mara is the multitude of inner demons that cause suffering. It is among those demons that the Buddha sat on the night he reached enlightenment. In Buddhist teachings, we call strong emotions like anger, attachment, jealousy, and arrogance poisons. They poison not just our own happiness, but also our connections with loved ones, friends, co-workers, and our local community. Sound familiar? That's because we are human beings, and the truth of suffering cannot be avoided. You may have noticed that fear is not on the list of poisons. Very likely, that is because fear is intrinsic to all of them. Fears can be rational or irrational. Rational fear is considered wisdom. It is wise to look before crossing the street, for example. It is wise to eat well. Irrational fear, on the other hand, is fear born not out of the present situation, but from imagined consequences or outcome from the past that we anticipate in the future. My younger daughter, Emilia, lives in Whitehorse and is very good at keeping in touch. However, if she fails to phone when expected, I catch myself worrying, what is wrong? What happened? All that really happened, she hasn't phoned. And when she phones unexpectedly, I can also wonder what's wrong. Why is she phoning now? Are my fears rational? Another story, one from my boyhood on the farm. A certain young man wanted to prove to his elders that he was brave. He would do this by going into the graveyard at night, under the full moon, and hammering a wooden stake into the grave mound of a murderer to prove that he had been there. It was very scary, a shaken young man reported the morning after. I was lucky to escape with my life. Just as I finished driving the stake into the ground and was about to leave, something grabbed me. It was so fierce that it ripped my cloak off my back as I fled. Curious now, they all went to the graveyard. Yes, the stake was there. And so was his cloak. The problem was that in his fear, the young man had driven the stake through his cloak, pinning it to the ground. I told this story to show how fear can compound fear and create a compelling but fearful reality, and sometimes even a good story. At times I've wondered, is everyone all over the world full of fear, full of emotional turmoil? Or is it more of a Western world phenomenon? I got some insight to the question from a recent article by Tolku Anyan Rinpoche in Lion's Roar, a Buddhist magazine published in the US. A Tolku is a reincarnate custodian of a specific lineage of teachers, of teachings in Tibetan Buddhism, who was trained from about the age of 3 by students of his predecessors. Tolku Anyan has lived in the US for over 10 years. He writes that not all cultures respond to painful emotions and unwanted situations in the same way. For example, in Tibet, people handle their emotions in a way that is less pervasive and less demanding. He writes, "When I came to America, I noticed the strong relationship Americans have with their emotions. People here focus on their emotions much more than we Tibetans do, and they are encouraged to do so. Emotions have become the core of American identity." I would say our identity. Almost literally, you are what you feel. He continues, and I found this part to be particularly insightful. Even the English language expresses this idea, the idea of this intimate identity with fear. We identify directly, very personally, with the emotions. Saying, "I am afraid," tends to intensify the emotion, implying no separation between the emotion and the one experiencing it. They are one and the same. "I am angry" is another example, saying that I and anger are one. Other languages, however, French and Spanish, for example, suggest a little more distance from the emotion by saying, "I have anger." Like, instead of "I am anger," "I have anger. Here it is, I'm here, here's the anger." In French, "j'ai peur," "I have fear." That's not, "I'm not afraid, I have fear." That's the way they speak. However, in the Tibetan language, we actually say, "Anger is present." It's not here, it's present. It's up there. And do not connect with the emotion, and do not connect the emotion with "I" at all. Many Americans comment on the joyful disposition of Tibetan people, especially when they travel there. This happy disposition may come from having a greater distance from their emotions. At times when I struggled with life's issues, I was reminded by teachers and psychologists that I was not my thoughts and feelings, suggesting that it would be useful to distance myself from the feeling and not become it. If distancing oneself from one's emotion is an Asian trait, I can't help but wonder if the Buddha's ability to distance himself from Mara helped him attain enlightenment. As stated earlier, Mara is the name given to the multitude of inner demons, the tricksters, the tempters that cause suffering. It seems that he saw Mara, who was tempting him repeatedly, with seducing him with everything imaginable. It seems he saw Mara as the passing parade of thoughts, someone or something to engage with, spar with, even befriend, not something to fear. He even invited Mara to tea. So there was this clear identification of the separation between what was between the feeling and the self. Our suffering may look different from the suffering of others, but all human beings experience painful emotions and unwanted situations. We all face separation from loved ones, falling out with friends, and the death of family members. I now want to share quotes from several esteemed Buddhist teachers who have helped me understand and even appreciate fear. From Thich Nhat Hanh, the beloved Vietnamese teacher, prolific writer of some 110 books on practical Buddhism. We are very afraid of being powerless, but we have the power to look deeply at our fears. And then fear cannot control us. The only way to ease our fear and be truly happy is to acknowledge our fear and look deeply at its source. Instead of trying to escape from our fear, we can invite it up to our awareness and look at it clearly and deeply. Words from Pema Chodron, amazing person who has a charming down-to-earth way of bringing Tibetan Buddhism to Western audiences, an author of the book When Things Fall Apart. Feelings like disappointment, embarrassment, irritation, resentment, anger, jealousy, and fear, instead of being bad news, are actually very clear moments that teach us where it is that we're holding back. Very clear moments that teach us where it is that we're holding back. They teach us to perk up and lean in when we feel we'd rather collapse and back away. They're like messengers that show us, with terrifying clarity, exactly where we're stuck. This very moment is the perfect teacher, and lucky for us, it's with us wherever we are. Then from Suzanne Siegel, a wonderful writer and spiritual teacher who sadly died very young. Very short and succinct. The presence of fear means only that fear is present and nothing more. The presence of fear means only that fear is present and nothing more. How to go forward in a world of changes, climate change, political change. Everything seems to be changing. Certainty is slipping away. The spiritual traditions of the churches is dramatically slipping. People have nowhere, don't rely on that source anymore, or less anyway. I think of several things. We have to do what we have to do. We know what we have to do. We have a practice to support us. We can follow Nike's tagline, just do it. Just do it. As a way of facing life, action-based but maybe somewhat lacking in awareness. Possibly somewhat lacking in awareness. I'm more inclined to heed the advice of psychologist Susan Jeffers, likely a non-Buddhist psychologist who encourages us to feel the fear and do it anyway. That is also a title of her book on fear. Preparing this talk was my perfect opportunity to look more deeply into the heart of fear for a greater understanding of myself and the world around me. I thank you for your attention and hope that bits of this talk will resonate for you also. I will now conclude with a poem by Mary Oliver, one of the great contemporary American poets. It is entitled, I Worried. I worried a lot. Will the garden grow? Will the rivers flow in the right direction? Will the earth turn as it was taught? And if not, how shall I correct it? Was I right? Was I wrong? Will I be forgiven? Can I do better? Will I ever be able to sing? Even the sparrows can do it, and I am, well, hopeless. Is my eyesight fading, or am I just imagining it? Am I going to get rheumatism, lockjaw, dementia? Finally, I saw that worrying had come to nothing and gave it up. And now, I took my old body and went out into the morning and sang. And I would add to that, and danced.
Chant on page 3 to close the Dharma talk.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to mend them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Once again, let's move our seats back to the wall, and we'll conclude with three bows.